Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The battle for the dollars first day consumers spend on groceries is heating up.
I think it's in flux. I think that we're going to see some changes. I think that we're going to see the legacy stores deciding what they can do and what they can't do.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida examines where and how people get their groceries is changing locally. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also sit down with Senator Tom Carper to chat about a variety of issues he's working on in Washington, D.C. Our arts playlist previews a symposium coming to the Delaware Contemporary, focused on technology and the visual arts. And the Dover band Hoochie Coochie visits our studio for an interview and performance. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We've previously discussed the state of retail shopping on this show, examining what's next for shopping malls and other retail centers across the first state. But there's another highly competitive battle for consumer dollars that often sparks strong feelings among those doing the spending, the one waged by grocery stores. The first state grocery landscape will be getting a significant addition in the near future as Wegmans enters Delaware for the first time with its planned location in Greenville. Where will it fit in with all the others, ranging from Whole Foods and Trader Joe's to Acme and Giant, and even the likes of Walmart and Target? We asked our retail specialist, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, to take a look at the lay of the land, and her piece on grocery options is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week so we could check out what she found. Let's start with the elephant about to enter the room, Wegmans. There is an almost cultish devotion to this store among some of its devotees. For those who are unfamiliar with Wegmans, what is the big deal?
It is a big deal, Tom. They have they're slightly expensive, but not as expensive as a Whole Foods or a Janssen's Market or things like that. And they have an incredible variety of foods, of fresh, gorgeous, wonderful foods. They treat their employees very well. So you have a wonderful, happy staff waiting on you. They just have great, great value.
So what will Wegmans' presence mean for other grocery stores in the area? And is this likely just the beginning of Wegmans building a footprint in the first state?
I think that Wegmans is going to do very well here and that they're moving to Greenville in Delaware based on the success of their Concordville store right over the Pennsy line. It means that everybody's got to step up their game and that they always have lots of inventory. They have gourmet things. They have everyday things that you buy, such as really inexpensive dairy products because they're from upstate New York and they have their own dairy farms. So I think it's really a game changer.
And they are kind of competitive with almost everyone in the market. So let's kind of like break down the market a little bit. You know, where do the likes of maybe the more higher end folks like Trader Joe's, Fresh Market, Whole Foods fit in with consumers?
I think that we're going to see a lot of crossover. And one of the things that I was really struck by in reporting this story was just how far people travel or how many places they go to spread those food dollars around between farmers markets and specialty stores like Trader Joe's and also traditional grocers like ShopRite, that people go pretty far afield and they go to a lot of different places trying because our palates have changed. We're all foodies now. And we want the best, and we have our favorites, and we go to the places that sell our favorites.
And like almost any store we do on shopping these days, I have to ask you about where do stores like Walmart and Target fit in? Obviously, they have a grocery aspect to them. What kind of impact are they having on this kind of overall grocery market?
They have a big impact, and Walmart in particular, which is having tremendous success with its curbside pickup. About 13% of Walmart grocery shoppers click and pick. They just go online, they buy their stuff, they cruise by and pick it up. They whether or not you shop at Walmart, Walmart saves everybody money because their prices are so competitive and it keeps everyone on their toes.
And you also mentioned in your piece that there's some European names that are also kind of coming into our area as well.
They are indeed. Lidl from Germany and Aldi from Italy. They have smaller stores, maybe 20,000 square feet, about the size of a Trader Joe's compared to an Acme or a ShopRite or a Super G, which are more than twice that size. They don't have as much inventory, and they don't have as many choices in terms of brands, but they have very good prices. They're no frills. Bring your own bag. And it's a great place for an inexpensive, high-quality shopping experience.
So having talked about all this, Wegmans and Trader Joe's and Fresh Market and Whole Foods and Walmart and Target and Aldi, where do legacy stores like Acme, Super G, ShopRite stand right now? What do they do to stay competitive?
Well, right now they're offering delivery. I don't know how long it's sustainable. With everybody ordering online, and it's expensive to have people who work in the stores pick from the shelves, to squeeze the tomatoes, to smell the cantaloupes like we do when we shop, and then pay somebody to drive it to you and gas up that car. So right now, I think it's in flux. I think that we're going to see some changes. I think that we're going to see the legacy stores deciding what they can do and what they can't do, and what they're good at, and how they're going to continue to compete.
You mentioned the online shopping piece of this and some of the challenges it faces, but this is something that a lot of people want, right?
It is. I think that we are really driven by convenience, and right now it's not costing us more. I think that what will shake down is when we actually have to pay for this.
And there is, beyond just the legacy stores doing delivery, there are other options there as well, correct?
We are ordering Blue Apron and Sun Market and various meals delivered straight to our homes, where everything is prepackaged and already measured out with a nice recipe card that we can put together a lovely meal. There are all kinds of options, including calling your favorite fast food restaurant and having them deliver.
So how about smaller specialty stores or independent grocers? Is there still room for them? And what do they offer that maybe the bigger stores can't?
I think that they're really in the sweet spot, because they're not trying to be all things to all people. So if you're a very healthy-oriented person, and consumers are increasingly thinking of food as medicine, and you have organic produce, you've got sugar-free, nitrate-free bacon, and you're focused on those kinds of products, that people who are interested in that are going to support you in that. I think that there are a lot of specialty stores that have things like very high-end cheeses, that they will have a place in the market.
Ultimately, what's the bottom line, do you think, for consumers, the ones that you talk to? How do they prioritize where they're going to spend their money on groceries and food?
First of all, price is still very important, and quality is important. They want a shopping experience that is pleasant, with a clean, cheerful store, with people to help you when you need it, and that they want foods that are fresh and beautiful and delicious.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. And a reminder, her piece on the grocery landscape in Delaware is online right now at delawarepublic.org. And stay with us. When The Green returns, we have an extended sit-down with Senator Tom Carper. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. There's no shortage of issues emanating from our nation's capital that are of interest to Delawareans. And occasionally, we like to spend some time chatting with members of the First State's congressional delegation about some of them. Recently, I sat down with Delaware's senior senator, Tom Carper, to delve into some of these issues, starting with what's next for the Mueller report, as Congress waits for Attorney General Bill Barr to deliver some form of it to lawmakers. What are your expectations for what will be delivered, specifically regarding how heavily redacted it might be? Should Congress, the public, beginning the full report, unredacted?
That's a great question. I think the first thing is we want to get as much as we can. Mm-hmm. The people used to ask Ted Kennedy, say, why did so many Republicans want to work with you? And they really did. He was their favorite Democratic dance partner on legislation. And he'd say, I'm always willing to compromise on policy, not on principle. I think the principle here is we need the truth. That's where we're going. And Thomas Jefferson used to say, if the people know the truth, they won't make a mistake. We need to know the truth. And if we can get that through some reasonable redactions, that's fine. If we can't, then we need to have the actual words of the report. So we'll see what we can get initially. I will say this. I was troubled. I did not support the Barr nomination. I probably would have, except for the fact that he put out a 19-page, single-spaced piece that basically said that the president's almost above the law, mm-hmm. cannot be prosecuted. And I think none of us is above the law, including presidents. So I think he walked into this job believing that presidents pretty much are immune from this kind of investigation and scrutiny. I don't think they are. And Bill Clinton certainly wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this Richard Nixon certainly wasn't. And I don't think this president is either. So we need to get to the truth. And hopefully we can with appropriate redactions.
Would you be okay with maybe the public not seeing a full report, but maybe Congress getting something that is not redacted or maybe less redacted than?
I think that may be a good compromise, particularly the committees of jurisdiction mm-hmm. have the opportunity, especially the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee have the opportunity to see the full document. I have a friend, Tom, you ask him how he's doing. He says, compared to what? And in the case of this investigation and the release of the findings of the investigation, I say, well, how about Ken Starr when he was counsel and looking into Whitewater, which started out as a land deal that went bad and turned out to be something entirely different. Mm-hmm. But that report was made fully released to the public. And so like compared to what in this instance? Well, compared to the Starr report, which is fully released, I think that sets a pretty good standard.
I do want to change gears here and go to a story that we did recently looking at PFAS contamination on and around military installations like Dover Air Force Base and mm-hmm. the Air Guard Base in Newcastle. As we reported, you've been raising questions with the EPA about a lack of urgency on groundwater cleanup standards and the possible pressure from the Defense Department and others to weaken those standards. I'm curious, since we have some time with you, what are you looking for short-term and long-term to deal with this PFAS contamination issue?
Mm, yeah. The EPA has set a certain standard. I think it's 70 parts per trillion for PFAS, for these permanent chemicals. There's a whole big family of them. And the folks at the Department of Defense, who I don't think get paid for making these sorts of decisions, say, oh, no, like 400 parts per we'll anything that's has contamination less than 400 parts per trillion, we don't think that should be cleaned up, really. So we have I think one of the rights that we ought to have as citizens in this country, I think we ought to have clean air. We have free speech and freedom of religion and all that. But we also ought to be able to know that when we turn on the taps of our water and drink our water, that it's not going to hurt us. And so we have this back and forth. But we fortunately, we have a system of checks and balances. In this case, I think there's some internal debate going on in the Trump administration between EPA and the folks at DOD. We, at the end, we want to, the principle here that we want to stay close to and follow is we want to make sure water's people can drink water and be safe and not have to worry about all kinds of complications with their health.
So short term, the question is the standard itself. Long term, what can be done then once you settle on that standard to really work and find mm-hmm. these spots and clean them up?
Well, we have the ability to measure contamination. And some of the contamination has been measured around the country from, in some cases, military bases where we use certain chemicals to clean airplanes and that sort of thing. But where in some of those places, the concentration of these, what we call them, permanent or forever chemicals, is as much as like a million parts mm-hmm. per trillion. And the standard is, according to the EPA, is 70 parts per trillion. talking about a million? Really? So I think the idea ought to be we don't have the money in Superfund cleanup to clean up every one of them right away. But I think our goal should be to start with the worst ones and start there and then work our way forward.
I want to move on to a little bit about the border and Central America. President Trump has backed off his threat to close the southern border with Mexico, but he seems deterministic by his plan to cut off aid to the Northern Triangle countries in Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. You've joined with a number of other Democratic lawmakers to oppose that move. And this is something you've talked about a fair amount. You were talking about it a lot during the debate over funding the president's border wall. What do you see as the primary dangers of cutting off this aid just like that?
Well, first of all, let me just say very clearly. I for a while, I was the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate. I've been on the border many times with Mexico and over toward the California border in Arizona. I was on the Arizona border right there with Mexico with John McCain a time or two. And I think we have invested since 2003 over $250 billion. To make our borders more secure, particularly the border with Mexico. I think if a country doesn't have secure borders, we've got a problem. But it can't all be about addressing the symptoms. The symptoms when people try to get into our borders, whether it's for economic reasons or humanitarian reasons or nefarious or criminal reasons. We could have a wall. We could actually have the 2,000-mile wall, 30 feet high. People still try to get here and turn themselves in and ask for asylum. And they live, in many cases, lives of misery. Their lives are made miserable by virtue of our addiction to drugs. So these drugs are trafficked up from Colombia and other places to the south through parts of Honduras, Guatemala, and Salvador, through Mexico. And it's a big business. And if we weren't addicted to drugs, you know, that problem would go away for the people in Honduras, Guatemala, and Salvador. Well, we are unfortunately deeply addicted in many cases. So part of what... and actually, this is the brainchild of Joe Biden. I've been involved in it as well, going back 4 years ago in the last administration. But the idea is create something that has worked before. In Colombia, 20 years ago, the country of Colombia was reeling under the FARC, guerrilla gangs, drug gangs trying to bring down the government of Colombia. One day, a bunch of criminals went into Bogota, the capital, and they took the Supreme Court justices into a room and shot them all to death. And so here's Colombia's reeling, and they reached out and asked if we would help. We did. We said, this is your country. You've got to do the heavy lifting. But we did things like provide Apache helicopters to provide mobility for Colombian troops, police to go all over the country in a very rugged terrain and go after the bad guys. We helped them raise revenues. We gave them some money, you know, through foreign aid and stuff, but we helped them raise money within their own country so that the wealthy people who live there would start paying some taxes. That's how I did it. Now, Colombia's a very successful country. It took a long time. But we've taken that model for what worked in Colombia, and we plunked it down in Honduras, Guatemala, and Salvador about 4 years ago. And the idea is to say, why do all these people want to get out of there, those three countries, and come to our country? Three big reasons. One, the lack of economic hope and opportunity. Two, crime and violence. And three, just so much corruption. It's endemic in those countries. And we've set up initiatives with these three countries. We put up in Salvador, for every dollar we put toward those three causes, they put up $7. We help leverage money from foundations, non-governmental organizations, private corporations, in order to address lack of economic opportunity and hope, address crimes and violence, address corruption. And it's starting to work. It's starting to work. But what we need to do is a combination of those things, root causes and stuff that we're focused on through three countries, and we just could do secure our borders. And the other thing is to make it clear to the people in these three countries that if they don't have a legitimate asylum claim, we're not going to forever let them come by the tens of thousands into our countries, get into our country and just like disappear and never go through the immigration process and so forth. That's just not a winning combination. I was on the phone this morning with one of the top officials at Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol, and to talk about, we had a great hearing before the Homeland Security Committee, trying to find out beyond what we're doing in terms of security on the border, beyond what we're doing in the Alliance for Prosperity to to work with these three countries on root causes. What else do we need to do? What more do we need to be able to do to stem this tide? But to do so in a way that's compassionate and humane to the folks in those three countries.
I want to talk a little bit about the president's proposed budget. There's been a lot of discussion about that in the past month. Are there some particular pieces that you find worrisome for Delaware and Delawareans?
I'm a senior Democrat now on the Environment Public Works Committee. The president has called for deep cuts in funding for environmental protection. We have real challenges in this part of the world. We have problems with groundwater quality. In particular, we have one out of six people in our state get their water from wells. And in some of the, particularly in the southern part of the state, the quality of the water that's coming out of those wells is not good. And so the idea of cutting by a third protection, water protection programs across the country, I'm not sure that's consistent with our values or what we'd like to see happen. The president called for a year ago a $1 trillion transportation infrastructure proposal.
Right.
He proposed to use $200 billion, again, a $1 trillion infrastructure program, roads, highways, bridges. He proposed to use $200 billion of federal money to leverage the states to do $800 billion. But while he was going to, with one hand, provide $200 billion to the states to leverage an $800 billion investment by the states, he was going to reduce other federal transportation program to the states by $200 billion. So I said at the time, I don't think that's going to work. Well, this time, in the administration's proposal this time, they don't do that. But unfortunately, they don't really have what I think is a workable plan either. But I've met with the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, came by my office, brought one of the top folks from the president's leadership team, works on congressional cooperation. And we had actually a really good conversation about what we could do to mount a very highly effective transportation initiative, and so I'm encouraged by that. It's not in the budget, but it's a start of a good conversation that I think can lead us to compromise.
I do want to quick hit on something that maybe didn't get a whole lot of attention. Maybe the attention it should have gotten. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell moved to cut debate for lower level agency and judicial nominees from 30 hours to 2 hours, citing Democratic obstruction as his rationale. Can you explain a little bit about what in practice this does to the process and what the ramifications would be doing this?
Yeah. We've founding fathers who crafted a constitution that was first ratified 5 miles from where we're sitting at this moment here in Dover. But they didn't agree about everything when they were working on the constitution. One of the things they agreed on was they didn't want a king. And they put in place in this Constitution this incredible system of checks and balances. And it's a hard way to govern. And it's not always easy to compromise and develop consensus. It's critical that we do that. But I think in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, I think the Republicans have gotten as many federal judges confirmed in 2 years as in 4 years, first 4 years of the Obama administration. And yet Mitch McConnell and the president say, well, that's not enough. Really? I would say, like, compared to what? Well, it's twice as many judges as were confirmed in the first 4 years of the Obama administration. And the idea of, I think, kind of like a running roughshod over the minority, it may work for a short while, but eventually the Democrats will be, there'll be a Democratic president. There'll be a Democratic majority in the Senate. And I say to my Republican friends when they're trying to push this change through, be careful of the bed you make because someday you'll have a chance to sleep in it.
I do want to quickly ask you about former Vice President Joe Biden. As we're awaiting a final decision on his 2020 presidential run, a handful of women have come forward describing instances of unwanted physical encounters with him. He released a video saying he recognizes social norms changing and promising to be more mindful in respecting personal space going forward. I'm curious, as you've watched this all unfold, what have you been thinking?
For a while, our state motto was, it's good to be first. When I think of Delaware, I think maybe a good motto was friendly, but you'll get used to it. And this is a state where I hug people. I hug women, I hug men, I hug children. I kiss babies. Joe does too. And I think it's accepted here. It's normal behavior, and with the people generally know us, and hopefully most of them like us. But they don't. They wouldn't let us hug them and kiss them. But in any event, in some other places, people don't feel that way, and they don't know us as well. And what might be acceptable behavior might be for some people unappreciated. So I think we just have to be really good. Not just in Delhi, but especially in other places, and be sensitive to how, put ourselves in other people's shoes and say, how would I want to be treated if I'm in their shoes? And Joe, I think he's handled it very well, and he's acknowledged that, that maybe what is the way we live here in Delaware is just not quite as acceptable in other places, and be more sensitive to that. And he's pledged to do that. And I think he's handled it just great. And I hope that we can go forward. He said he's going to be careful in the future. I'm sure he will be. Maybe I should be too.
Do you think it changes the calculus at all whether or not he's going to run or
what his prospects are? No, not at all. Not at all. I'm hopeful that he's going to run. I think he'd be a great great candidate. I think he can win. I think he can unite our party, but not just our party. I think he can unite our country. And I think he can help return our standing in the world of nations, and we need that.
Thanks to Senator Tom Carper for joining us on The Green this week. Next, in our latest edition of Arts Playlist, we head to the Delaware Contemporary for a preview of an upcoming symposium there. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The 2019 Gretchen Hupfel Symposium, called Imminent Realms, Light, Images, Sound, is coming to the Delaware Contemporary next month. Catherine Page is the Gretchen Hupfel Curator of Contemporary Art at the Delaware Contemporary in Wilmington. She says the May 18th event will feature an exhibit by Philadelphia-based photographer and multimedia artist John Singletary, and a panel discussion with experts in the fields of photography, technology, and performing arts. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Paige about the symposium and Singletary's exhibit.
Coming up in May, the Delaware Contemporary will be presenting its biannual installment of the Gretchen Hupfel Symposium. Let's talk about it. What's going on here?
We're excited because we have an exhibition forthcoming, Anahata, with the works of John Singletary. And so this symposium, Imminent Realms, Light, Image, Sound, will feature or will become the fulcrum. And so it is called Light, Image, Sound because John Singletary's work is photography. And so this symposium will address the intersection of visual stimuli and the impact of changing technology on how we perceive and understand our world. And so the focus of the symposium, it aims to investigate the influence of visual language of contemporary photography practices. And then that information in the technological age, and then on our ability to broaden our understanding of each other with the world. And what's unusual about John Singletary's work is that it employs this cutting-edge photographic technology, the OLED, which is organic light-emitting diodes. And I am not an expert in photography by any stretch of the imagination, but what the OLED does for a photographer is when you have a shutter on your camera, when you have an f-stop of 8 and then you have an f-stop of 22, it changes the depth perception. And so the OLED is, it wants to diminish that depth of dimension so that what becomes real at a distance becomes much more focused up close. And so it reduces that, I guess, that chasm of reality. And so it's very exciting to see that. And so we're also going to have a panel discussion from diverse scholars, artists, and technology experts. And each of them will share their knowledge on advancements in the imaging field using technology to engage and inspire public discourse and also inform.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the panel of speakers. Do you want to point out anybody in particular?
Well, besides John Singletary, the artist, we have scholars such as Carla Guillerón Montero. She is a professor at the University of Delaware in cultural anthropology. And so she applies her anthropological expertise with complex multiple meanings and representations of identity. We've got Priscilla Smith. She's also a professor at the University of Delaware. Her expertise is in material culture, what she calls art geneering. And so she began exploring the photographic medium as an undergraduate. And she engages both science and photography, and it's led her to work exploring fine art as a medical and forensic photographer. So she gets into the details. And then Tim Alessi, he is he works for LG Corporation in user experience. And so he will address the OLED technology and how it compares with traditional LEDs and other screen technology for visual as well as social consumption.
All right, so we're talking to Catherine Page about the 2019 Gretchen Hupfell Symposium, Imminent Realms, Light, Image, and Sound. It's scheduled for Saturday, May the 18th. I'm just looking through the program here. The symposium will conclude with a reception and a dance performance. Talk about that.
Oh, yes. So Megan Hannon, she is with the South Carolina Dance Consortium. And so she will perform at the conclusion of the symposium. We'll have a light reception. And she's one of the dancers that John Singletary has photographed. What John Singletary does is he kind of acts as a director. And so there's choreography, there's musical composition, and then there is the design and arrangement that he manipulates his photographs. And so Megan Hannon is one of the dancers. So you have this aggregate of artistic expression all going into his photographs. And so she will be dancing to the original compositional music. And so it's a way to extend that experience of the symposium of light, image, and sound.
Catherine, is this symposium free? And if
yes.
So, okay, so you answered that. How can people register for it?
They can go to our website, www.decontemporary.org, and register.
Now, you mentioned early on, I want to revisit this, you mentioned early on that the symposium is planned in conjunction with John Singletary's exhibition. When is that on exhibit? Immediately after following the symposium or
mm-hmm.
prior to?
That's an excellent question. John Singletary's exhibition, Anahata, opens on May 3rd. We have a special preview on May 2nd. It's a ticketed event. And then it closes, the exhibition closes on September 22nd. So we'll be here for a while. And because this is an unusual exhibition, it's a special ticketed event. And so the ticket prices are $10, and then children 13 and under are free.
Thanks to Catherine Page, the Gretchen Hupfell Curator of Contemporary Art at the Delaware Contemporary in Wilmington, for joining our Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist. You can learn more about the Gretchen Hupfeld Symposium at decontemporary.org. And The Green wraps up next with Enlighten Me, featuring an interview and studio performance from a local Dover band, Hoochie Coochie. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Dover-based band Hoochie Coochie has been playing rock and roll at venues across the Mid-Atlantic region for the past few years. The quartet writes catchy pop songs with a positive message, walking the line between contemporary garage rock and more traditional funk and blues. And for this week's Enlighten Me, three of the band's members, vocalist Danielle Johnson, bass player Mark Reed, and guitarist Fats Hawkins, dropped by the Delaware Public Media Studios to chat with our Nick Schellino about soon-to-be-released music and upcoming local shows, as well as play a tune.
So how did this band get started? Let's start there. When was it first conceived?
Well, back in like 2015, we were all literally in separate projects. Yeah. So we knew about each other and stuff like that. I kind of had a taste to do something different. I was making a lot of hip-hop at the time with my cousins and stuff. We were in a group called Flow City. It was really cool, it was really tight, but it wasn't feeding me artistically, is conceited as it sounds. And I was like, I want to do something that feels more me. So I knew Fats played guitar, so I hit him up. He was literally the first person I hit up, and I never really.
Yeah, that's perfect timing, too, because I just, like, stopped doing things with my last band. So It was, like, the day after she messaged me and was like, hey, you want to come jam? I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
So how does the songwriting process work then? You have lyrics, you show them to Fats, and that's where it goes?
Originally, it was like I would have some lyrics that I was just working on that didn't really fit with the band that I was in currently, the hip-hop band. And then Fats is just like a natural-born musician. He just plays. He always has ideas.
Bluesman.
He forgets them. He like makes, yeah. And I'm like, play that thing you were playing that one time, and he won't have a clue what I'm talking about. But he always had something. He always had some kind of riff or something really, really cool that fit with the lyrics that I was that I'd presented at the time.
You said that the lyrics for this band didn't quite match up with the hip hop project. Where do these lyrics come from? What's the message you're trying to put out, and why is that? Mm-hmm. You said it felt more you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had been making hip hop since I was like a kid. It was accessible. It was easy. Like my cousins were into it, so I was like, okay, let's do this. And then as I got older, I think kind of like just the culture behind hip-hop I wasn't able to relate to, and I was having a hard time connecting to my audience. And I just had a lot of, like, grown-up stuff going on, you know? Like, I had a partner, so I wasn't really into the whole, like, side chick or, you know, thing. I was like, nah, I wanted to write about, like, true love and, like, true heartbreak. And I feel like you definitely can do that in hip-hop, but in the group that I was in, it just wasn't, that wasn't the idea. So I was like, well, I don't want to not do it. So I feel like this project is a bit more true to myself and who I am now.
Okay, well, should we do a song?
Yeah.
I think we're ready for a song.
Yeah.
All right, what are you guys going to play?
Our first song we're going to do is the single off of our current EP. It's called Walkin'. The EP is called Walkin'. It's just about, like, love and bringing people together and all that good stuff. So.
All right, Walkin'. Let's hear it.
People has come together, don't be
Turn off your television, united and not divided. It is the way. The media will fool you. Stand up, I know you fed up. Can't take no more. March for truth, fight for love, peace for all. Won't get like your feet hurt, child. Oh, 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 oh. I said you won't get like your feet hurt, child. Oh, 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 oh. You won't get like your feet hurt, child. Oh, 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 oh.
That's a cool tune. That is a very cool tune. So how long ago did you guys write that one?
Walking? That was on our last EP, so before August. I don't know, man. We write so many songs sometimes, like hard to keep. It was a while ago. I don't know, man.
So when's the... Here, Fats, get your microphone over there, man. So when are you guys working on anything now? When's some new music coming out?
Yeah, actually, we have a single. It's BBW. Stands for Big Bad Wolf. We recorded it at Minor Street Studios with Brian McTeer and his whole Weather Vane crew up in Philly. They're really, really cool. We had an absolutely phenomenal time. It was like we kind of lucked out because it was like a workshop for them, but we got to keep the music.
Yeah.
And we come in there and it's just like everything is just so pristine and like, but like has this old school feel. Exact. It was us. It was like we walked in and it was like, this is it. And then we had this awesome New Jersey artist, Miss Deanna West. She did an animated music video for it. So we're going to give that to you guys, but you got to wait for it. We'll do that song later for you if you want us to, but that's going to be coming out on July 15th.
You did just mention the sort of old school feel, the maybe timelessness sort of aspect. Like, you guys definitely have... just like a traditional sort of rock and roll bass to these like catchy tunes, and there's definitely a modern sound there. But like you said, you know, there's a sort of a traditional rock and roll thing. What are some of your influences? And this is a question for everybody.
Well, we came up with the name because a lot of Muddy Waters. Yeah. So that was like an influence for me with a lot of the blues styles we come into.
It's a lot of the Chess record stuff.
Right. We did a lot of Black Keys like stuff when we first started too, because we liked their grungy sound and everything and like that. And we had Alabama Shakes were like a big thing for us for a while, still are. But you know, what else we got? I mean, there's so many different people that we listen to.
Life.
And now we're going through a couple different bands. That, like, it's pretty cool, man. We just try everything out, and now our sound's changing. And now even.
Yeah, like we at our last practice at we were working on this new song, and our drummer Chelsea, she was like, we're not even like really an indie blues band. We're like more like a, what'd she call it? Funky Soul Blues.
Funky Soul,
Funky Soul Blues. Yeah, a little bit of funk in there. I know. I grew up in church, so watching my mom sung. So, like, watching her sing on stage, I was like, that's tight. That's really tight. I want to do that. And then, like, listening to other genres and stuff, I picked up on different things that I like. But that, like, Southern kind of, like, Baptist singing style for me, nothing beats it.
Yeah.
Nothing beats that style. So whenever I get on stage, usually, honestly, I'm just pretending to be my mom. It's, like, a whole big game.
Well, there's a special thing about religious music. It's hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to quite articulate what that is, but it is a powerful thing.
Yep.
For sure. So you guys have been on the scene here for a few years now in Delaware. Have you noticed it change at all in that time?
Yeah. We actually have a lot of support. I just had some buddies up down to visit me from Jersey, and we were walking around, even in Wilmington, we were walking around, and this lady was wearing these pants, and I thought they were cool, so I was like, hey, I like your pants, and she was like, I like your music, girl, no. You got it going on. So, I mean, when we come around here, people are just generally, everybody loves musicians, everybody loves them.
Yeah, so is it different when you play in other states around the Mid-Atlantic? Is it more of an away game, and then when you come back here, there's more of that local group of friends? Is there any difference there?
I definitely can see the fans and stuff growing when we go out, and I feel like just because of our vibe, like how we have a good time together and we interact with our crowd and our audience and our fans and the new people and the bands, like people just, it's always a loving feeling whenever we're on stage and we get off. People tend to be like, wow, you guys are from Delaware? I drove through there once.
Well, yeah, when I came out here, I had to look at a map to be like, where am I moving to?
Right. But it's cool, though, because you're right next to everything that's going on. So,
well, yeah, I imagine it's a good spot to be a band because you can just drive an hour and you're in a bunch of different cities that
yes.
you can play.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess one more time, where can folks see you guys, hear you guys in the near future? Where are the shows at?
You definitely got to follow us online. Most of our stuff is just like at Hoochie Coochie Music. We'll be on Instagram, Twitter. If you aren't into big on social media, but you like, you know, you just want to hear the music, you can find us on Spotify, iTunes, Apple Music. I think we're even on Tidal, which is like, that's sweet.
Huh, I didn't even know that.
I know, right? TuneCore, baby. Shout out to TuneCore for helping for helping artists put their music online. And yeah, we'll see. If you're in Delaware, you definitely should come out to see us on the 26th at Kelly's Logan if you're up north. But if you're down south, we'll be at Miss Spillion River Brewing Company in Milford, and that's going to be freaking tight. We got some new songs. We got some funky soul blues for you for that show. So
it's going to be a good one.
Thanks to the Dover Band, Hoochie Coochie, and Arnick Schlino for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Nick Schelino, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.